What I'm going to present is called Covenant. I think I wrote on the program Sabbath and the New Covenant. Yes, correct. Okay, so that's what I'm going to present. I have a slightly different title on the draft here, but what this is a manuscript that I did publish in Ministry Magazine, and so this again is good advertising for Nick Saddlemar. By the way, the history of this, I'll mention briefly because this is a topic I've published on in several places, and so you may be interested in getting published versions in various forms. This project got started by Nick Saddlemar himself because he commissioned me to write a paper on Sabbath and the New Covenant for a dialogue that Adventist leaders had a few years ago with the Worldwide Church of God down at Ambassador University in Pasadena, California. And so we went and we met with them and I read the paper and they were not very convinced, but they were, you know, that church has been split because they used to keep the festivals plus the Sabbath. And then a bunch of them threw out the festivals and they threw out the baby with the bathwater. They threw out the Sabbath with it. And we were trying to convince them that just because you don't have to keep the festivals doesn't mean that the Sabbath shouldn't be an ongoing timeless expression as well. So in any case, that's where that came from. And then I subsequently published that as an article, Sabbath and the New Covenant, in Journal of the Adventist Theological Society, issue 10, 1999. And that was published online in sdanet.org/@issue. And then I wrote a much longer version commissioned by the Biblical Research Institute, BRICOM, and that is called The Role of God's Moral Law, Including Sabbath, in the New Covenant. And that's published online at the Biblical Research Institute website, where, by the way, since I'm giving commercials, you need to see this website. It's very important. It has a lot of wonderful resources that BRI is going to a lot of trouble to put up there for people to have access from all over the world on various topics. And this is one of those topics. So that's a much longer paper. If I read that one, we'd be here for a long time. So then, as a result of that, one of the members of BRICOM was the former editor of Ministry, and he commissioned me to write an article, Justly Integrating Covenant Law and Sabbath was the title that came out. And that was an abstraction, a boiling down of that longer paper, and that's published in Ministry, February 2004. And that's the version I'm going to give you now, since that's all I have time for. But I thought I would let you know where the others are in case you want to get this. I get asked about this all over the place. People email me about this question because there are people who are thinking that they, as Adventists, they need to keep the festivals. Others are confronted with this covenant theology of, or I would call it pseudo-covenant theology, of Dale Ratzlaff in his book, Sabbath in Crisis. When I read that book, I realized the Sabbath was not in crisis. It was Dale Ratzlaff in crisis. The Sabbath is doing just fine. But that book was full of non sequiturs, and it just was very poor. Much, in my opinion, the logic, the exegesis didn't flow. And I think that our previous papers demonstrated that. A much better job was done by Pope John Paul II. I don't know if he had help from the Virgin Mary or something, but that was really a beautiful, beautiful piece of work. I mean, the Sabbath is so beautiful and glorious there in the Old Testament. It's magnificent. And then it just slides right over to Sunday so effortlessly. It's beautiful. Magnificent. Okay, so I don't agree with that, but in this longer paper, particularly for the BRI, but also the other versions also here, I will address that kind of thinking towards the Sabbath. I better read the paper. Yes. Many Christians today believe that when the Old Covenant of the Old Testament gave way to the, quote, New Covenant or New Testament of Christianity, the entire Old Covenant law became obsolete. Thus, since the seventh-day Sabbath was part of that law, literal Sabbath observance is no longer relevant or required. This approach has been adopted by a broad spectrum of Christians, from those who hold that Christians are not bound to keep any particular day, to others who slide aspects of the Old Testament Sabbath over to Sunday in order to make it a Christian Sabbath. Now, the former view is Ratzlaff. The second of those is the Pope, John Paul II. I think probably soon to be Saint John Paul II. All right. In the present study, we will ponder the place of the seventh-day Sabbath in biblical covenant and law and its role in the new covenant era. In the process, we will discover that a balanced interpretation of all Scripture, and I emphasize balanced and all, reveals a picture radically different from the approach described above. The first section is called Waves of Grace. In the Bible, the divine covenants are unified and they function as phases of development, in God's overall plan. Here's a quotation from John Walton, who is a friend of mine. He teaches at Wheaton College, not a Seventh-day Adventist. Each of these covenant phases is part of a single unified program of revelation. The enactment or primacy of one does not mean the nullification or subordination of another. None of these covenants replaces the one before it. Each supplements what has come before. That's foundational to a correct biblical understanding of the covenants, and extraordinarily important for us as Seventh-day Adventists, formulated by a man who's not an Adventist, which gives it more weight because he saw it from the Bible, not influenced by our biases. Okay? In the New Covenant prophesied in Jeremiah 31, all of God's covenant purposes, including preservation, promise, and law, climax in Jesus Christ, who is priest and king. Thus we see that cumulative phases of God's unified everlasting covenant bring wave upon wave of gracious divine initiative throughout the Old Testament times and on into the New Testament, where the comprehensive culmination in the ultimate revelation and only truly effective sacrifice of Jesus Christ washes over the human race with a tidal wave of grace. Now that's a little out of date. It should be a tsunami of grace. Like the New Covenant, the Old Testament covenants were based upon grace rather than law. That is so important because the skeletal structure of the whole Bible, Old and New Testament, is covenant. The basic theme of the whole Bible, I believe, and I've arrived at this by exegesis, is God is love. And that's not just, I didn't get to that by warm, fuzzy feelings. That's through hardcore exegesis. God is love. And he expresses his love through these covenant phases, which structure the entire Bible. Like the New Covenant, the Old Testament covenants were based on grace rather than law. For example, only after God delivered Noah and his family did he formalize or ratify a covenant with them, in the process of which he stated some stipulations or laws. So the laws were for people who were already saved by grace. Ever since the fall, the only way to salvation has been by grace through faith in the seed or posterity of Eve, that is Jesus Christ. Notice the difference to modern politicians. Politicians promise, then they're elected on the basis of the promise, then they're inaugurated, and they make whatever stipulations. But what does God do? He makes a promise, then he delivers on his promise, and then the covenant is ratified or inaugurated. So you already know that he is delivering on his promise. The politicians, you don't even know if they're ever going to deliver on their promises, even after they're long voted out of office. You see the difference? So we have these covenants for people who are already saved. God says, I brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Therefore, God never gives his commandments to people who are not already saved. That's important practically for dealing with young people. When we try to lay down the law to young people about standards and various things, if we haven't already led them to Jesus Christ, then that becomes legalism at that point. But we need to lead them to Jesus Christ first, and then everything else will flow from there. Okay, Paul's distinction between under law and under grace in Romans 6, 14 to 15, has to do with states of persons who are under condemnation by the law or freed from condemnation through Christ. This is not a distinction between two different dispensations or ways of being saved. There's only one way of being saved from the very beginning, and that's by grace you are saved through faith. Both of these states could characterize people within the Old Testament or the New Testament eras. According to Paul, Christ has eclipsed the Mosaic Torah in the sense that he is vastly more glorious, effective, complete, and therefore adequate revelation of God's character. Christ did not replace God's holy, righteous, good, and spiritual law, Romans 7, as a means of salvation from sin? How could he? Because God has never offered salvation on the basis of law. Next section, enduring principles. Both within the Bible and elsewhere in ancient Near Eastern covenants and treaties, law operates within the framework of covenant. If we accept God as the authority behind the whole Bible, and if we recognize that his covenants are cumulative, it stands to reason that laws given in connection with the Old Testament covenant phases should at least in some way inform our ethical conduct. Some biblical laws, such as the Ten Commandments, and many of the civil laws, such as Deuteronomy 22, verse 8, you've got to build a parapet around a flat roof to make sure that people don't fall off the roof and get hurt. Some of these can be applied today in a straightforward or fairly straightforward manner, except that church discipline replaces the civil penalties administered under the ancient Israelite judicial system, which no longer exists. Many laws are applicable in principle, even when the culturally dependent specifics do not apply to us. For example, if someone's ox or donkey goes astray, you're supposed to return that to the person. Now, in our community, we don't have oxen or donkeys. We have, in our family, we have chickens and goats and dogs and a cat. Our neighbors have llamas and so on and so forth. But we don't have, but you see, the principle applies. Those were just examples. The Israelites had other animals as well, like camels, for example. But we're supposed to use what's between these two ears, right? That gray matter that God gave us, to figure out how the principle applies. There are some biblical laws that we cannot keep if we no longer have the social institutions they were designed to regulate, such as levirate marriage. Except when I did speak on this in Papua New Guinea, they said, we have levirate marriage. That was very interesting. The ritual laws, which were dependent and centered upon the function of the earthly sanctuary temple as the dwelling place of God, can no longer apply because that institution is gone. There is simply nothing for these laws to regulate. You get the idea? Laws regulate something. If that something is gone, which the laws have regulated, they can't regulate it, right? We have a lawyer right here, Brad Maris. You would agree. I see you shaking your head. Thank you. I feel better. Since the ascension of Christ, our worship is focused towards God's sanctuary in heaven. However, we can greatly enrich our comprehension of God's relationship to human beings through study of the Old Testament ritual laws. For example, laws against slavery. Now, slavery, unfortunately, exists in the Sudan. In India, over 10 million people enslaved in India. In the sex slave trade, which is going on in this country right now, and especially in Asia, places like Bangkok. But in this country, we don't have slavery as such. But we can learn from those laws, can we not? Because they teach us how to treat those who are subordinate to us and working for us and dependent upon us. So it can affect how we treat our employees, including our secretaries, and so on and so forth. Okay, you get the point. Although circumcision was a ritual law, it predated the sanctuary temple system and was not dependent upon it. So loss of the temple in the first century AD does not remove the possibility that circumcision could be an ongoing requirement. Cessation of this requirement is based on another principle. Membership in the new covenant phase no longer requires membership in ethnic Israel. Is there a single criterion that can be used to determine whether such a law should be kept today? Now, this is a very bold thing to do. And this is a hypothesis. It's an attempt. And I'm still testing it, and you can help me test it. This is an attempt to state in one sentence a rule of thumb for determining whether an Old Testament principle or law should be kept today. And here's how it goes. A biblical law should be kept to the extent that its principle can be applied unless the New Testament removes the reason for its application. Okay? I'll read it again. A biblical law should be kept. Then I qualify. To the extent that its principle can be applied, unless the New Testament removes the reason for its application. I have to add the one about the New Testament because of circumcision, which could be kept today, couldn't it? But the New Testament has removed the reason for its application because it removed the meaning that it pointed to, namely, the continuation of ethnic Israel and those boundaries as the boundaries of the channel of revelation that God was using to reach the world. Those boundaries are no longer there. I don't believe in supersessionism in the sense that we throw out the Jews. No, I don't believe in that. As Dr. Dukan has pointed out, that's a very anti-Semitic kind of view. But what I do find in Acts 15 is that God broke down the boundary walls of partition so that all of us, whether Jews or Gentiles or anyone, can experience the blessings of chosenness. We're all chosen now. And so it's not God taking away, it's God adding us. We're grafted in, as Paul told us about. And of course, the reason why we're grafted in is for the same reason that God chose Abraham in the beginning, and that is to be channels of revelation in the world. It doesn't mean that we're all saved, right? It means that we're channels of revelation in the world. We have the opportunity to be saved, and it matters what we do in the world because we have that covenant connection to God as part of the covenant community. We affect His reputation by whatever we do. And that's an extended meaning of the third commandment, "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord your God in vain." See, because if we take His name as Christians and then we live like non-Christians, then we have taken His name in vain in a larger sense. All right, so I basically agree with Gordon Wenham when he concluded that the principles underlying the OT are valid and authoritative for the Christian, but the particular applications found in the Old Testament may not be. For example, the law of levirate marriage, Deuteronomy 25, 5 to 10. If two brothers are dwelling on an undivided estate, and one of them dies and leaves his widow childless, you know what happens, right? The brother needs to raise up seed for the dead and to help his sister-in-law get pregnant so that the line can continue. This was very important. There are other passages about this. Genesis 38, Ruth 4, and so on. All right, folks, if I take the approach that that culture is irrelevant in interpreting these laws and deciding what is applicable today, then I need to say, I read and then I do. Well, folks, Angel, we need massive reform in the church. We need to be implementing this law of levirate marriage. We read it's there. It's a law. We've got to do it. However, what does the Apostle Paul say to Timothy? Rightly dividing the word of truth. He doesn't just say read and do. He says rightly dividing. That means analyzing or parsing the word of truth so that we don't read and then do. It's not knee-jerk obedience that God wants. We read and think and then do. And so we need to look at that and we need to say, not exactly what was it that was called for in that particular law, but rather what was the underlying principle, the timeless principle that needs to be applied. Because it's applied within a culture. God doesn't reach people in a cultural vacuum. He reaches people within cultures. And then we need to see, what is the cultural garb? Perhaps I live in a different culture, but the principle is timeless. I am in no way am I setting up culture as an authority for determining principle. No, not at all. It's just that. Principles are worked out within cultural contexts. And I think that point is incredibly important to us as we deal with these questions of the applicability of law, and also in terms of the fact that we are an increasingly multicultural church. And we need to, in some ways, apply principles in somewhat different ways according to where we live in the world and what cultures we belong to. This, we have to be very sensitive to each other. There's the stumbling block principle and all of these other things, but hopefully that can help in discussion. My approach reverses that of Douglas Moo, who says, we are bound only to that which is clearly repeated within the New Testament teaching. I disagree 180 degrees with that. Next section, four aspects of Sabbath. Categories such as moral, health, civil, and ceremonial laws, which imply the extent to which a given law remains applicable, are post-biblical analytical classifications, and a law may fit in more than one category. There's nothing in the biblical text that explicitly places the Sabbath laws in one category or another, and we must allow for the possibility that they belong to more than one category. In fact, various laws involving Sabbath can be viewed as pertaining to each of the four categories. Is the Sabbath a moral law? Yes or no? Of course it is. It's in the timeless moral Ten Commandments with other moral commands. Is it a health law? Yes, it is. Exodus 23:12, the benefit of Sabbath rest, includes a physical component that benefits animals as well. So it must be physical. Is it a civil? Does it affect the civil area under the ancient Israelite theocracy? Yes, a man gathering sticks on the Sabbath day. Was it affecting the Israelite ceremonial system? Did that system honor the Sabbath? Yes, special sacrifices on the Sabbath day. The bread of the presence, the so-called showbread, changed once a week on the Sabbath. Leviticus 24, verses 5 to 9. So you see that Sabbath is involved with laws belonging to all four categories. Moral and health rules of the Sabbath rest are timeless and remain, even when civil penalties and ceremonial performances pass away. So it appears that ceasing from work on the seventh day Sabbath should be kept to the extent that its principle can be applied. We will test this provisional conclusion by considering some potential objections. First objection, seventh day Sabbath observance was commanded only for literal Israelites. There is no explicit biblical record that the requirement for Sabbath observance was expressly formulated as a law before God commanded it to the Israelites in Exodus 16 and 20. But who says that a divinely mandated duty does not exist until or unless God commands it in the form of a law? If this were true, why would God have held Cain accountable for murdering his brother? You don't find a prior command saying, "Thou shalt not murder." In the early chapters of Genesis, where Sabbath is first mentioned, God was concerned with setting up the ideal order of relationships rather than commanding protection of existing relationships. And in fact, we find that the basic principles behind all 10 of the 10 commandments arise from the principles behind marriage, Sabbath, and work, which were the three creation institutions. On the seventh day of the creation week, God, by his example, instituted refreshing cessation from work for the benefit of all human beings. Jesus confirmed this when he said that the Sabbath was made for humankind, made for anthropos, and not humankind for the Sabbath. Jesus' view that God did not simply intend to benefit himself on one occasion when he rested at creation is supported by several contextual factors in Genesis. First, God blessed the Sabbath day. Elsewhere, God blessed things for the benefit of his creatures. Secondly, human beings were made in God's image. God rested. Stands to reason that man should rest also. On each of the first 6 days of creation, God did something that had ongoing cyclical results, or at least ongoing results, for our world, including cyclical time. The seventh day Sabbath is the birthday of the world, which cannot be changed because it celebrates a historical event that has occurred at a point of time in the past, long before the nation of Israel existed. Nothing that human beings do or do not do can affect the holiness of the Sabbath itself. Sabbath also signifies dependence upon the one who created and sanctifies people and keeps all human beings alive. And I have texts for all of these. Since God will always be our creator and sustainer, the basic meaning of seventh-day Sabbath rest, which encapsulates the divine-human relationship, cannot become obsolete as long as human beings inhabit planet Earth. O. Palmer Robertson, a Presbyterian scholar, was true to the Bible when he wrote, "Neither antinomianism nor dispensationalism may remove the obligation of the Christian today to observe the creation ordinance of the Sabbath." The absence of any explicit command concerning Sabbath day observance prior to Moses does not relegate the Sabbath principle to temporary legislation of the law epoch. God blessed man through the Sabbath by delivering him from slavery to work. And I say I'm a AAA type personality. I need there to be a command thundering from Mount Sinai. I say, "Roy Gain, thou shalt not work on the Sabbath." And it's only because of that command that I don't feel guilty not working on Sabbath. Praise the Lord. If that's legalism, give me more legalism. Objection 2. Literal seventh-day Sabbath observance is no longer relevant because it was a temporary type or symbol of Christian rest. And here I debate with the Pope and Dale Ratzlaff. I'm sorry that the Pope is not here to hear this. Some see support for this approach in Hebrews 4, where Sabbath rest symbolizes a life of peaceful rest involving all days of the week, which results from believing in God. However, a historical or horizontal type, like the Israelite sacrificial system, prefigures something in the future, which constitutes its antitype. When the antitype commences, the type becomes obsolete. In Hebrews 4, God's rest has not suddenly become available for Christians. It was available all along and was not fully appropriated in Old Testament times only because of unbelief. Because it was available at the same time when the weekly Sabbath was in operation for the Israelites, the weekly Sabbath cannot be a historical type of the life of rest. You get my point. The types are things that are pointing forward to something in the future. When that future thing arrives, that reality, the type ceases its function. But the Sabbath was in operation all the way along. It doesn't function like that. Because it was available, this Sabbath rest was available in Old Testament times, and they didn't get it just because of faith. Now, I'm going to skip the next section, which is on Colossians 2, because I don't want to contradict my dear friend, Ron Dupre. But you can read what I've written in the articles I mentioned. I have a slightly different view. And Ron has... I just have a few minutes, do I? Okay, yes, I'll be quick. That'll save time, too. Confirming the conclusion that the literal seventh-day Sabbath cannot be a temporary type is the fact that God instituted it for human beings before the fall into sin. So it was not one of the temporary types or symbols that God set up after the fall in order to lead human beings to salvation from sin. Objection 3. Sabbath is like circumcision in that the New Testament has removed the reason for its application. To the contrary, the non-ceremonial Sabbath principle of rest on the seventh day is not mentioned as abrogated or altered in Acts 15 or anywhere else in the New Testament. Moreover, by restoring internalized holiness and obedience through God's Holy Spirit, the New Covenant restores the Sabbath to its true significance. Instead of being a hypocritical tour de farce, Sabbath points to a living reality. People who are allowing God to sanctify them keep the sanctified day. Because their sanctification means that they emulate the character of Holy God, who is love, the fact that Sabbath is a sign of sanctification implies that it is a celebration of holy love. It's not legalistic. Charles Feinberg has argued, every moral principle contained in the Ten Commandments has been reiterated under grace by the Spirit in the form of an exhortation, with the single exception of the command to keep the Sabbath. But he missed the fact that the Sabbath is special. It was reiterated in the New Testament not merely by an apostolic exhortation, but by records of Christ's repeated example. Jesus risked controversy and danger by making a point of healing people on the Sabbath, thereby giving rest from suffering and showing that the real purpose of the Sabbath was for humankind. His recreative healing reveals the heart of the New Covenant and agrees with the emphasis on redemption in the motive clause of the Sabbath command in the Deuteronomy version of the Decalogue in Deuteronomy 5. Jesus said that because Sabbath was made for man, the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. This divine lordship over the Sabbath was part of his claim to be the Messiah. During his ministry, and this is my punchline, Jesus showed Christians how to live under the new covenant. Why would he claim the seventh day Sabbath as his, the Lord's day, and reform its observance if he were about to do away with it? That would make as much sense as investing in a house and remodeling it just before demolishing it. Thank you.
There's time for one question if someone has a question at this time. I think that your arguments were so cogent that kept everybody speechless.
Or else
thank you, Roy. Thank you, Roy. Yeah. Oh, Steve has a question.
On the hermeneutic of let's find principle versus the cultural application,
right.
I don't have any great problem with that, but some critics would say, look, the principle is one day and seven, the cultural application was seventh day. How do you not get torpedoed by principle?
Okay. Because when you look at the Ten Commandments, where you have just apodictic, bald statements of principle reduced down to their essence, you find there the Sabbath as the seventh day. You always find it tied to that. You can't separate it. And that's from the very beginning, and it's based upon the fact that the world was created in 7 days and because of what God did on the seventh day. So it's that's part of the essence. And this is part of the exegesis of looking for these principles, is we have to look for all the relevant factors to see how big or small is the principle. And so I find there that the seventh day itself, the identification of that day, is part of the principle. You can't separate it from that. Yeah. All right. And that's really God's ownership over the world as the creator. And by the way, the word Yahweh, which is God's personal name in the Old Testament, is a causative, hifil form, apparently, of the verb hayah, to be, which is so the hifil causative means the one who causes to be, the creator. The creator is right there in his name, Yahweh, which is Jehovah, is a bad transliteration in the Old Testament. So his creation is intrinsic to his identity to us as Lord of planet Earth. And that's why you find it also in the three angels' message. Worship him who created heaven and earth, the sea and the fountains of waters.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage you. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.